then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 9th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
The moon, there beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Edgar Steele has now finally broken his long silence, and he's in the process of writing his own account of what's been done to him. I published the first installment on my Thought Crime blog, entitled Seeing is Disbelieving, and I'll be publishing the complete series in Northwest Observer as well, of course. I should remind all of you, by the by, that the Northwest Front does publish a monthly magazine, 16 pages long, called Northwest Observer. It ain't Time or Newsweek, but it serves to keep people who don't have access to personal computers apprised of what's going on. I refer to elderly people who don't understand computers or never owned one. I refer to prisoners. And I refer to a surprising number of white people who have made a conscious decision to shut off their computer, put it back into the box, and not have these stupid machines in their lives at all. Now seriously, I'm coming across more and more people like that who've decided that it's just not worth the trouble and the lunacy of having these things turned on and sitting on your table. And so they've made the decision to turn them off, box them up, put them in the garage, and go back to a simpler and better way of life. Well, they go through a period of withdrawal, like with any drug, and then they seem quite happy. There's a couple of them I regularly send CDs to, recordings of my Radio Free Northwest podcasts that I burn for them on my own computer here, and so they get to keep up with what's going on. Now, so far as I'm aware, there are only two groups left in the entire movement who still publish a regular printed newsletter or publication. Now, these are Willis Cardo's American Free Press, which comes out every week, and our own Northwest Observer. David Duke, or one of Duke's flunkies back here in the States, probably publishes a Duke newsletter still, but I haven't seen one in a long time. And as I recall from the last few that I received down in Astoria, they were mostly just fund appeals anyway. There may be others, since I haven't kept up with everything that's gone on for the past few years, but that's all I'm aware of. I believe that the publication of a regular hard copy periodical or journal, or better yet, a tabloid newspaper when the time comes, is a vitally important part of any revolutionary movement for a variety of reasons. Now, I know nobody ever believes me when I keep saying that we're going to lose the internet someday, but if it does happen, we need to have something we can fall back on, and that's the printed word. Now, we may end up having to do like they did in Soviet Russia and go back to what they used to call samizdat publications, which consisted of essays and leaflets and pamphlets and sometimes whole novels typed on typewriters with about 4 or 5 carbon copies and passed from hand to hand. A lot of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's early work was originally circulated hand to hand like that throughout Russia in the form of sometimes barely legible carbon copies. At one time, the Soviet regime was so worried about samizdat that they strictly controlled all photocopy machines and anyone who had access to photocopy machines. If you worked in a government department or something, all of the photocopiers had to be licensed and registered and regulated, and each sheet of copy paper was strictly controlled. You could never make your own copy, but you had to hand the job over to a low-level KGB clerk who examined the documents and filled out all kinds of forms, so forth and so on. At one stage, it was even against the law in the Soviet Union to be found in possession of more than 3 sheets of carbon paper, I think it was. And you could only buy carbon paper 1 or 2 sheets at a time. And you had to sign for it and fill out a form stating what you wanted it for, so forth and so on. Now, that just goes to show how paranoid a despotism can get about the printed word. And we're starting to see signs in this country that the American despotism is becoming just as paranoid about the Internet. So I repeat, we may lose it. And if and when that day comes, we will need a printed periodical to fall back on to communicate with our own people. Another reason I'd like for eventually the Northwest Observer to transmute or transmogrify into a tabloid newspaper is so that eventually we can have paper sales. Also, tabloid newspapers are great for mass distribution, much better than mere leaflets or stickers. I envision in my mind a Northwest Observer with a press run of 300,000 or 400,000 copies and hundreds of people all across the Northwest passing out copies to various interested people in their network. Now, you know, before 1917, the Bolsheviks eventually built their revolutionary party within Russia itself based on the distribution network for their newspaper, Pravda. Yeah, I know we're a long way from having that kind of money and that kind of manpower, but it will come once we can let the millions of people who support us know that we're here. Okay, enough rambling on that topic. Now let's get on to something I've touched on somewhat in the past. V-Bulletin boards and or their slightly less complex cousins, PHPP forums on the Internet. Most of you will be familiar with the 2 major V-Bulletin boards in our movement, Stormfront and VNN. You may also be familiar with a number of smaller V-Bulletin boards, such as White News Now, White Nationalist Info, eNationalist.com, and a few others, almost all of which were founded by people who were kicked off Stormfront or VNN by one of the deranged moderators and who got pissed off and decided to set up their own little internet empire. None of these other boards have come close to getting the registered membership that the originals have. White News Now claims about 2,300 members and eNationalist.com claims about 1,700, but as far as actual regular participants, there's only a couple of dozen people on each. I can tell you from experience, believe me, long email lists of people who do nothing but lurk, and you never have any idea of who they are or the nature of their interest, are pretty much useless. These are meaningless numbers. Just like we have, apparently, between 3,500 and 4,000 listeners to Radio Free Northwest every week right now. And when we got that Rachel Maddow publicity last January, we were getting about 15,000 hits a day for a while there, but the vast majority of you I never hear from, and I have no idea who you are, what you're all about. Now, we could have 1 million listeners every week on Radio Free Northwest, and VNN or White News Now could have 500,000 signed on forum users. And if we never hear from any but a few dozen of you, then it's the same as if we only had a few dozen people. It takes a long time dealing with the Internet before you really come to understand just how unreal it all is. And the fact that these seemingly huge numbers are nothing but electronic images on a screen. None of it means anything at all if it doesn't produce real-world action and events. Now, just to show how easy it is to get pulled into the false world of V-Bulletin and the Internet in general, in my first version of this podcast, I spent about 5 minutes going over several specific examples of things that have happened to myself and other Northwest Front supporters when they tried to participate in various V-Bulletin forums. And it wasn't until I looked it over before recording that I realized what I'd done. I had allowed myself to be sucked into this whole cyber world as if it were something real and crucial and central to the racial struggle, which it isn't. And it seems that even I'm vulnerable to the lure of the net world if I don't watch myself, even though I, of all people, ought to know better. So I won't do that. But I will remind you guys that up until recently, we had a board like that of our own, a PHPP forum called NorthwestRepublic.com. It was run by a Canadian kid whom neither I nor anyone else ever met, and did so perfectly for almost 2 years before he went wobbly and dysfunctional, and then he disappeared, leaving no one the necessary access codes and server information to keep the group going. This is a fairly typical movement experience these days. Now, this is one reason why we need a functioning and professional general headquarters for the Northwest Front, where everything is run by people who live within half an hour's drive from one another, so that if something like this happens, I can go over and pound on the guy's door and find out what the hell's going on. But that doesn't seem to be on the cards for the moment, although we're trying. And so for the time being, this field is wide open for someone who wants to give it a whirl. You guys keep asking me, what can I do, Harold, what can I do? While simultaneously making it pretty clear that you have no intention of doing what I really need for you to do, and that's pack the moving van and get your ass up here. So if you want to start your own Northwest Independence-oriented V-Bulletin Board or PHPP form, fine and dandy. You don't need my permission. The Northwest movement, the Northwest migration, is not my personal property. I didn't think it up, and I am not some kind of fearless leader that has some kind of veto or control over what somebody wants to do regarding the Northwest. Now, so long as you don't do anything really weird like preaching communism or putting interracial porn on the side or babbling about space aliens, and Bob's your uncle, and I'll do what I can to drum up some membership for you. And by the by, all three of those things I just mentioned have appeared on both Stormfront and VNN in the past, so I wasn't making them up. Now, please understand that running one of these bulletin boards properly takes a lot of time, effort, and computer expertise. And when it takes off, then it's damn near a full-time job. Now, that's why I can't run one myself, like I said, because I just don't have the time to do it right. Now, I, for one, have no problem with Don Black and Alex Linder soliciting funds on their sites, because like anything else, doing this right is a hell of a lot of work, and it represents a serious commitment of their time and attention. Now let's give the devils their due. You guys out there, let me know if you want to try this, and we'll kick it around some more. Now, I've got some inquiries asking if Access Sally was going to be back this week, and sure enough, here she is. Okay, it's kind of an experiment here. Access Sally and me are just going to sit and talk about a few things, have a little bit of a discussion. At some point, we want to do a kind of a normal, you know, radio talk show type format on this show. So I suppose we need to practice a little bit about that. But the trouble is, you really, in order to do this right, have to kind of ad-lib it. And we haven't thought about what we want to say. What would you like to talk about?
Well, Harold, actually, somebody sent me an email asking a question, and I said that I would ask you and get back to them. And they wanted to know what your opinion was on Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, the God Hates Fags guy.
Yeah, he also, I believe, likes to go around and picketing military funerals. I never quite got why he does that. I've got nothing against, you know, him. You know, he's obviously a Christian, and he doesn't like bugger boys, and neither do I. But a lot of the problems that we have in the white community as a whole come from our fascination with single-issue politics like that. And it's not just faggots or just abortion or just guns or just, you know, the Obama birth certificate. What we face is a totality of crisis in our whole civilization. It's not enough just to try and solve one problem. You've got to solve the whole situation. The whole society that we live in has to change from top to bottom.
Yeah, and to me, he just sounds like a real nutcase. I mean, blaming every single thing in the world on fags and on God's, or America's acceptance of fags for some reason. And the thing with the military funerals and the children's funerals, it just makes no sense. And I don't think anyone's going to listen to anything worthwhile he may have to say after something like that.
Yeah, well, a lot of these Christian extremists do have some strange ideas. I'm not trying to insult, you know, anybody's religion, but they want to introduce creationism in the schools and everything like that, which is fine. I mean, I have no problem with the idea of intelligent design of the universe being taught in schools, but a lot of these people, they don't want intelligent design taught as an alternate theory. What they're looking for is some kind of state endorsement of this idea that their version of Protestant evangelicalism is the true one. And of course, back when I was growing up in the South, they pretty much had that in those days. I mean, it was just assumed that everybody around you was a shouting Baptist, and that was it. And even Roman Catholics were considered to be a bit peculiar. But single-issue politics like that tends to lead to obsession. And, of course, in this society, we get a lot of obsessed people.
Obsessed people. Okay, and again, with the single issues, clearly Fred Phelps is not a racialist. But if you do take one single issue, such as fags or abortion or whatever, they're probably the single issue behind all that is Jews. Who's pushing this stuff on us?
Oh, yeah. If you look at any problem in this society, you will eventually find race or the Jews at the bottom of it somewhere. Sometimes you have to dig. And, of course, the Jewish question is really a racial question as well. So race is the central issue in American society. It always has been. Everything in America for the past 400 years always in one way or another gets back to race. Like I say, sometimes you have to dig a little and you have to research a little. And you have to kind of trace things back to their point of origin to find where the racial angle comes in. But the economy, politics, the Civil War, culture, just about any drugs, just about anything, it all has a racial angle because in America, race has always been the issue ever since the first one of Columbus's sailors plugged an Indian with his matchlock musket.
And I guess really, Fred Phelps has not accomplished one useful thing, despite doing a number of these street sign pickets every day. There's still just as many fags, just as much corruption and disease and perversion.
Yeah, well, that's democracy for you. I keep saying this, I don't think people really get it sometimes, but the purpose of democracy is to prevent change. The purpose of democracy is to make sure that the people who have power keep the power and stay where they are, and they are not placed in danger through any genuinely revolutionary situation or anybody that really wants change. Now, we all know, I think, in the backs of our minds, how change actually comes about, and we simply don't have the moral or physical courage to do it. But democracy as a whole does not solve problems. What it does is it allows people like Phelps and people with single issues, you know, abortion, whatever, to just let off steam. In essence, democracy is a safety valve. The entire democratic system and the entire electoral system is set up with the idea in mind of preventing the very type of change that we want to accomplish.
That's all I got.
Okay. Okay, you want to read your poem now?
Okay. Hi, guys. This is Axis Sally, and I got a request this week from one of our listeners who calls himself Bear, and he wanted me to read this poem for him. It's called The Wrath of the Awakened Saxon by Rudyard Kipling. It was not part of their blood. It came to them very late, with long arrears to make good when the Saxon began to hate. They were not easily moved. They were icy, willing to wait till every count should be proved ere the Saxon began to hate. Their voices were even and low. Their eyes were level and straight. There was neither sign nor show when the Saxon began to hate. It was not preached to the crowd. It was not taught by the state. No man spoke it aloud when the Saxon began to hate. It was not suddenly bred, it will not swiftly abate, through the chilled years ahead, when time shall count from the date that the Saxon began to hate.
There you go. Next week we'll have you reading Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, I think. Oh, laugh into the microphone. Why not?
Wait, I'm done laughing.
Why not?
I already laughed.
Okay. All right, there you go. Okay. Last week, I played a parody cowboy song called The Ballad of Irving, and a couple of you asked when I was going to play some real cowboy songs. Well, I have done in the past. I played the Texas Rangers and The Sky Above, The Mud Below with Tom Russell and Big Iron, but I haven't played any Western music for a while, so here's Marty Robbins.
Out in the streets of Laredo, as I walked out in Laredo one day, I spied a young cowboy wrapped all in white linen, wrapped in white linen as cold as the clay. Drum slowly and play the fife lowly. Sing the death march as you carry me along. Take me to the valley, there lay the sod o'er me. I'm a young man. cowboy and know I've done wrong. I see by your outfit that you are a cowboy. These words he did say as I boldly walked by. Come sit down beside me and hear my sad story. Got shot in the breast and I know I was dying. Go fetch me some water, a cool cup of water, to cool my parched lips, then the poor cowboy said. Before I returned, his spirit had left him, had gone to his maker, the cowboy was dead. Oh, beat the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. Sing the death march as you carry me along. Take me to the valley, there lay the sod over me. I'm a young cowboy and know I've done wrong.
Well, we're back, and Axisalli and I were sitting here thinking, what could we talk about? And I believe she has some things she wants to say about prison correspondence and conditions in one penal facility specifically.
Okay, first of all, prison correspondence is something that's very important to me. I think that every white racialist should be corresponding with at least one comrade behind the wire. I think that, with a few exceptions, no white man or woman deserves to spend the rest of his or her life buried alive in a living hell with no one to talk to. I have more pen pals than I can count, and I'm never too busy to take on another one. If any of you have somebody to whom you correspond with that could use some more mail, then definitely send me their information. Doesn't matter what I'm doing, I can always make room for another one. And recently I've learned that... Maybe you can jump in with how all this stuff at Coffee Creek started.
Yeah, I know white people have a very bad habit of just forgetting about our people the minute the prison gates shut and, you know, cutting them loose. And it's always been one of the habits I wish we could break. Now, as many of you know, for some years now, actually, we've been corresponding with a number of white women prisoners here at the Northwest Front. It started out with a couple of ladies who were down in a prison in California called Chowchilla. And one of them was moved up to Coffee Creek Prison here in Oregon. After some consideration, I don't think I'm going to actually name any of these inmates because we've got a little bit of a situation building here. Basically, the administration at the Coffee Creek Women's Prison has begun persecuting a group of about 10 white female inmates in various ways because of their correspondence with the front. And it's gotten to the point where these women are being subjected to very definite abuse in the form of unnecessary and uncalled for solitary confinement. And apparently some worse things than that are going on. It's kind of hard to tell because, of course, their outgoing mail is censored. And it's a bit of a touchy situation. But something has developed whereby, in essence, we are being threatened by the prison administration down there to either back off and just disappear, or else they're going to retaliate against these women, who are, of course, totally helpless to resist in any way. Now, this is a kind of a hard call because, on the one hand, I honestly don't want to be responsible for anything happening to these women. But on the other hand, I, as a revolutionary, cannot and will not allow a situation to develop whereby an official of the state is dictating to me and to the Northwest Front what we can and cannot say and what we can and cannot post on our websites. Now, that doesn't happen. Not ever. So it's a bit of a dodgy situation here. I am in the process of trying to do something about this, which I probably should not get into because we have been informed that, among other various government agencies, the prison authorities in Coffee Creek are monitoring our website and presumably these podcasts as well. But that's a situation, and I do feel that it's necessary to at least mention the fact that it's going on just to make clear that even though there is a possibility of retaliation against these prisoners, we cannot and we will not allow ourselves to be intimidated, and we will not simply turn a blind eye and ignore what's going on down there.
Yes, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Several male prisoners were writing to us here at the Northwest Front asking how they could subscribe to The Observer, and I was asking Harold, well, what do we do about this? I mean, are we going to take these people's money that they worked really hard for and just send them something that's going to not even get to them? And Harold told me, no, that only happens at Coffee Creek. The other prisons, they accept the Northwest Observer and other correspondence from us without a hassle. So apparently whatever is in The Observer that's going to cause some outbreak of racist terrorism in Coffee Creek gets through to other prisons just fine. I don't know why that is.
Well, the thing is with Coffee Creek, and this is just the issue of mail being rejected. Now, as Sally mentioned, occasionally a male prison will reject some, you know, piece of literature of ours, but generally Northwest Observer is not really an extreme publication. It doesn't have headlines that say, you know, kill niggers or anything like that. I haven't had any trouble getting Northwest Observer into most male prisons for years. Generally, I found that it's kind of arbitrary. It depends on which guard is on duty that day in the prison mail room and what kind of mood they're in. But it's very rare, and it's not systematic like it is in Coffee Creek. In Coffee Creek, the excuses for sending mail back are just obviously contrived and ridiculous. Like, they send it back with a notice saying there was a foreign object, a foreign substance on the envelope, and you look at the envelope and some guard has spilled coffee all over the envelope, which clearly was not there. They claim that when I used to tape the envelope shut that it was a foreign object. I don't know, maybe they thought we were smuggling LSD on the Scotch tape or whatever. So fine, I stopped that. And then the two weirdest ones that we've had so far is the mail being returned, now get this, returned to us because the return address is stamped on the envelope, as those of you who are on the mailing list know, marked no return address, or else the sheet inside states that the text of Northwest Observer on page 2, page 7, page 9, whatever, contains coded messages that allegedly would incite disorder in the prison, and that's about as bizarre as I've ever seen it. And essentially, these people clearly just don't want white women receiving a racial message. In the male prisons, unless it's something really outright violent or it contains images of dead niggers or something like that, generally speaking, especially in the federal prisons, they will let it through. There are certain male prisons that have stupid rules, like the Missouri State Prison where David Tate is held will only let a prisoner have 6 books in his cell at any given time, and when he wants to order a new book, he has to get rid of one he's got, and then they have to do a whole thing with ordering. But that's not even so much malicious, it's just bureaucracy. But this business at Coffee Creek is getting very, very strange. Some of the excuses that they have for rejecting our material are just becoming really off the wall. The coded messages bit was what got me.
Okay, and then recently, one of the female comrades there, she was sent to solitary confinement for an indefinite period of time for writing a poem in praise of one of the greatest people ever to walk this planet, David Lane. Now, the poem was her own personal property. It was meant only for her. And because of the one dumb nigger in the mailroom, I think that what needs to happen is this poem, which I have with me right now, needs to be broadcast all over the air so that every one of our 6 million listeners can hear it. Okay, this is called Never Forgotten. Born on a Wednesday in a town called Woden, ironic, you say, or a true son of Odin. He fought for the white, not giving up even when snared. He brought many to the light, and then was silenced because they were scared. Sheer truth is what he spoke, whether or not all agreed. He lived and died for our folk, served a real purpose as decreed. We can honor him with more words, or wake up and take heed. Leave the quarrels to the birds, and rise up together by way of deeds. Of the greatest folk hero was our comrade, David Lane, as one who defied the enemy's chains, as one who planted a seed in many brains, as one who overcame the pain as Woden's son giving the 14 words in his name. None of this will be in vain. Hail David Lane.
This lady sent me a copy of her official order into solitary confinement for something like 45 days for the crime, and this was actually cited on the document, of possessing a poem in praise of David Lane. This is the kind of thing that's not supposed to happen in America, and she's not the only one. These women are being placed in solitary confinement with no reading material and no contact with the outside world 23 hours a day, but also in a situation we have reason to believe involving poor food, sleep deprivation, no heat in the winter. In essence, it's pretty much a form of physical abuse and torture. As I say, I am trying to get some of the people in authority interested in this case. I always figured that the fact that these were women and they were female would give them at least a certain amount of status as a politically protected minority, but apparently not. If a woman has a white skin and she's racially aware, apparently she's considered no more worth legal protection than a man, no more deserving of the protection of the laws and the Constitution than a mere old white boy like me. But I do believe that it's necessary to mention this, again, to make it clear to whoever's listening that no matter what kind of retaliation you practice against these women, we won't be intimidated. We're not going to forget them. We're not going to back off. We're not going to be quiet and let you just do whatever the hell you want to them in there. I did get one letter from one of the prisoners requesting that we not mention them anymore on the website and this sort of stuff, but what the prison authorities, I don't think, were aware of was that this woman had written me some time before when all this started, and she told me, said, "Harold, if you ever get a letter from me demanding that you back off and stop sending us Northwest Observer and stop writing and stop mentioning us on the website and everything, disregard it, because I will be writing that letter under duress at the hands of the prison authorities." This is institutional terrorism. In essence, what the prison authorities in Coffee Creek are doing is telling us to back off, give up our constitutional rights to comment and to protest against the treatment of these women, or else they'll basically hurt the hostages, and that's what these female prisoners are. They are helpless in there. They are, in essence, being held hostage, quite literally, by men and women with guns and clubs and gas and torture equipment. And the implication is pretty clear that if we don't back off, that they will be harmed in some way and at the risk of initiating harm and retaliation against these women. And I repeat, I'm very painfully aware of the possibility of this. I have to say, no, we are not going to back off. Somehow or other, I will eventually get somebody to listen, and somehow or other, something is going to be done about this. I can't say how now, because, as I said, these are white women and they have no legal rights. But, as Sally said, we don't give in to terrorists. And what is being done in the Coffee Creek Women's Correctional Facility in Wilsonville, Oregon, is institutional terrorism. I am probably most well known for the Northwest Independence novels that I wrote over the past few years, but just for the record, I am by no means the only white nationalist fiction writer around. There is, of course, The Turner Diaries and Hunter by Dr. William L. Pierce. There is Tom Chittum's fairly well-known Civil War II, a number of other lesser works. But two recent books have caught the attention of our little subculture. And as it happens, I was asked to give advance reviews on both of them. The first is a book by a young man named Kyle Bristow, and it's called White Apocalypse, which is basically about the Solutrean hypothesis. In other words, the belief or idea, which seems to be more and more founded in fact, that the North American continent was settled by white Aryan pioneers and migrants from Europe starting about 9,000 years or so ago before the Indians arrived. And this is proven by such evidence as Kennewick Man, the Spirit Cave Mummy, the European-style Clovis spear points found in Virginia, so forth and so on. This whole Solutrean thing may sound a bit esoteric for most people, but it definitely drives the liberal establishment batshit, and they got so upset over Bristow's novel that it even merited an individual smear attack from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And the second book that I was called upon to review recently was Ward Kendall's Hold Back This Day, which was originally written around 2001, but it was recently republished by Greg Johnson's Counter Currents Group. I actually wrote a kind of blurb that appears on the back cover, Anyway, Gretchen the librarian did a short book review for us.
Evening, comrades. Today, I'd like to talk to you about Counter Currents Publishing. They have a whole series of interesting books. Recently, I just read Ward Kendall's Hold Back This Day. And it's actually, this has been around since 2001, but apparently Counter Currents just started publishing it. It's about a one-world government that is going on in the 22nd century. And as you can imagine what might happen, they've decided that they want everybody to be a 5.5 complexion rating. So they have socially engineered genocide to make sure that happens. And it's about a schoolplex teacher named Jeff. He is a social undesirable born of two unblended Caucasian parents. He was born in Australia, and he also has one son who was also born unblended from a first marriage. His wife ends up being killed in a riot, so he gets remarried to someone who's blended because there's extreme social pressure. It's really almost a law. You have to marry someone who's blended. He has a tendency through most of the book to support world government, although I can't imagine why, really. But he's afraid of world gov, and he needs a paycheck, and he's concerned for his white son. I don't want to give the whole thing away, but it's very exciting. And you really see the conflict that Jeff has, that his son has. He has to look out for his own self-interest. He's trying to survive. A lot of the time you feel like he's going along with it too much, but he really doesn't have really any choice. So I found it a very powerful book. It has all these interesting futuristic terminologies and sort of a newspeak, I guess you could say, language to it. So you should look up Counter Currents if you haven't already done this. And it's counter and then there's a dash currents. And there's another group on the web called Counter Currents, which has left-wing books, but this is obviously a different Counter Currents. The next two books I'm going to get are going to be Religious Attitudes of the Indo-Europeans and then Racial Elements of European History by Hans F. K. Gunther. So maybe I'll talk to you about those sometime in the future. Yeah, thank you for listening.
Second music break. Back when I was a child in the 1960s, as difficult as it may be for some of you to believe, we were actually taught about the history of our own race in this country. And there were a lot of popular fads and songs on television and on the radio and whatnot based on actual white history that praised men like Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, Benjamin Franklin, so forth and so on. A lot of the old Walt Disney Presents shows that used to come on Sunday night were very strong on white history. We had shows on the Civil War. The war in those days was not a forbidden topic that could only be approached through the prism of political correctness like it can be today. Anyway, even Confederates like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were favorably portrayed on television and in the movies and in the general culture in those days. Now, that's all over now. But back then, there were certain singers who actually made a number of short records about white history, notably Marty Robbins and Johnny Horton. Now, they sound kind of alike, actually, when you listen to them. I played you a Marty Robbins song just now, and if you'd asked me, I would have said that this next song is him as well, but Amazon.com says it's Johnny Horton. I do remember, though, playing this song when I was about 8 years old on my little toy kid's record player. That was a 45 RPM. Anybody besides me remember those? The ones with the big holes in the middle. And those little children's record players didn't have a spindle, so you had to put a yellow plastic sleeve in the big hole in the middle so the 45 would play. Anyway, this is the Ballad of the Alamo.
In the southern part of Texas, in the town of San Antonio, is a fortress all in ruins that the weeds have overgrown. You may look in vain for crosses and you'll never see a one, but sometimes between the setting and the rising of the sun, you can hear a ghostly bugle as the men go marching by. You can hear them as the answer to that roll call in the sky.
Colonel Travis, Davy Crockett, and 180 more. Captain Dickinson, Jim Bowie, present and accounted for. Back in 1836, Houston said to Travis, get some volunteers and go fortify the Alamo. Well, the men came from Texas and from old Tennessee, and they joined up with Travis just to fight for the right to be free. Indian scouts with squirrel guns, men with muzzle loaders, stood together heel and toe to defend the Alamo. You may never see your loved ones, Travis told them that day. Those who want to can leave now, those who fight to the death, let them stay. In the sand he drew a line with his army saber. Out of 185, not a soldier crossed the line. With his banners a-dancing in the dawn's golden light, Santa Anna came prancing on a horse that was black in the night. Sent an officer to tell Travis to surrender. Travis answered with a shell and a rousing rebel yell. Santa Anna turned scarlet, played to play low, he roared, I will show them no quarter, everyone will be put to the sword. 185, holding back 5,000. 5 days, 6 days, 8 days, 10. Travis held and held again. Then he sent for replacements for his wounded and lame. But the troops that were coming never came, never came, never came. Twice he charged, then blew recall on the fatal third time. Santa Anna breached the wall, and he killed them one and all. Now the bugles are silent, and there's rust on each sword, and the small band of soldiers lie asleep in the arms of the Lord. The southern part of Texas, near the town of San Antonio, like a statue on his fiddle rides a cowboy all alone. And he sees the cattle grazing where a century before Santa Anna's guns were blazing and the cannons used to roar. And his eyes turn sort of misty and his heart begins to glow, and he takes his hat off slowly to the men of Alamo, to the 13 days of glory at the siege of Alamo.
All right, I'm going to talk about something now that I get sometimes as a heckle from Jews and goat-dancing morons, and sometimes as a serious and troubling question from comrades who are genuinely concerned, as well they might be, because this is a potentially very serious issue. The issue or question is usually phrased something like this, quote-unquote, Harold, what are you going to do when you get up one morning and you log onto your computer or you turn on CNN and you see that a major bomb has exploded somewhere in Seattle or Portland or Spokane, or somebody serious in the establishment like that Jew talk show host Alan Berg has been gunned down, whatever, and somebody calls up the local media and claims credit in the name of Company C, 1st Battalion Northwest Volunteer Army or something like that. Now, we're not talking about some nutcase going berserk in a shopping mall and killing a bunch of blacks and beaners and then blowing his brains out as the cops close in and then they find your books in his room and northwestfront.org on his computer history, so forth and so on. Now, that's a scenario you've mentioned before, but what we're talking about here is something by way of for real guerrilla action against Zog that looks as if some people have just decided to quit waiting and fast forward the tape right to the NVA stage. Now, how will you react then, Harold, goes the question. Yeah, I suppose it's a possibility something like that could happen, although I question whether any of us is at this point sufficiently competent to put together anything like that without getting infiltrated by a Larry Fairfax-style informer, or without somebody in the group freaking out and going running to the U.S. attorney, blubbering to play Let's Make a Deal. Now, as a matter of fact, our level of competence at that kind of thing is so abysmal that if it did happen, my first reaction would probably be that it was a government black op of some kind. especially if the target was a kindergarten full of cute little Jewish kids in yarmulkes like that loon Buford Furrow went after, or cute little colored pickaninny girls in braids and ribbons like in that Birmingham church, that kind of horse shit. I'm sorry, guys. Long and the short of it is, I just don't have any confidence in our ability actually to do anything like that, given the situation regarding our lack of moral fiber. Now, remember, I've seen the real thing close up, and we are not IRA or UVF men, believe me. Now, that's what pisses me off about all these FBI fabrications framing poor sickle men like Edgar Steele and Bob Chambliss and J.B. Stoner or those huddery militia goofballs, people like that. These sons of bitches in their silk suits know damned well that the people who sign their paychecks, the only people that really count in this society or in their minds, aren't in any danger from us and never have been. What they do to guys like Ed Steele is just pointless, sadistic cruelty directed against weak, soft targets who can't fight back. Kind of like those nasty-ass little boys who pull the wings off flies. But in answer to the question as to how I would react, I can give you a general idea, but bear in mind it would all be very conditional and it would be absolutely dependent on the exact circumstances as to what happened when and how and so forth. I say again that anything like that would probably be directed in an elementary school full of kids or a hospital or a playground or something like that for the purpose of ginning up a media feeding frenzy that would alienate all white people in the Northwest from us and would lead to my books being banned or whatever that they were really after. Now, if it was something stupid like that, something really obvious, I would publicly denounce it as a government black op, which it most likely would be. And, of course, I would be ignored. Realistically, though, I doubt I'd be around long enough to react in any way. And I presume that if something like that ever actually did go down, I would probably have my door kicked in by the SWAT team and the whole 82nd Airborne Division, even before I had time to get out of bed and log on to Drudge Report to see what had happened. And my first knowledge of it would probably be the sound of my door splintering and screaming niggers in body armor and masks beating me to the floor with rifle butts, after which they'd send me off to Guantanamo or wherever to be tortured, while the FBI strips my house down to the floorboards and carts every computer, every piece of paper, every book, every CD, every kitchen utensil, and every tube of toothpaste from my bathroom away in plastic tubs to be buried in some government vault never to be seen again. Now, this is why I'm circulating and in some cases publishing draft chapters of my fifth Northwest novel, Freedom Sons, right now. Normally, a writer never lets anybody see his first draft of anything, but I need to make sure that if anything like this does happen to me, the entire novel number 5 isn't taken away on my hard drive and buried away forever from the knowledge of man. Now, in the unlikely event that someone did start an NVA and actually begin doing things, and I was somehow allowed to remain free and with access to all you guys in the media, which they might do at first in hopes that this NVA, whatever, would contact me and lead the secret police to them that way, then the question is, how would I react? Well, it would depend, first of all, on exactly what the so-called NVA was doing and how they were doing it. Now, if they were just obviously, a small clique of movement clowns who read my books and decided over the sixth beer, yeah, let's do that. And then they ended up robbing Pizza Huts and shooting themselves in the foot or blowing themselves up like those idiot rich kid weathermen in the Greenwich townhouse or harming white civilians in some way or generally turning in our usual Three Stooges performance, then I would probably try to talk to them through the media to the effect of, hey, morons, you need to go back and read the books again and get your act together. Although I doubt I'd be allowed to do that. If, through some incredible chain of events that right now simply isn't possible, a genuine NVA were to appear in the Northwest, I'm talking about guys who had sense enough to stay the hell away from me during the planning stage because they know that I will be the first place that the FBI and the other secret police look for them, guys who are sufficiently competent and courageous actually to break the regime's credible monopoly of armed force and commit acts of physical resistance and not get caught. Now, then I can't say exactly what I'd do because I can't predict what I will be allowed to do, which probably isn't much. If any such thing ever happens, I will be immediately arrested on any charge that they can think of, or no charge at all, and I'll either disappear or else I'll become the Nelson Mandela of the Northwest, pardon the expression, most likely just disappear. I think the establishment is smart enough not to allow a white Mandela to arise, which is one reason I suspect they murdered David Lane in prison. But in point of fact, you know, guys, something like this actually did happen once, over a quarter of a century ago. A group of men and women called the Order read Dr. William L. Pierce's Turner Diaries and decided that it was time for fiction to become fact. A lot of people don't realize that Robert J. Matthews was, in fact, an active member and organizer for the National Alliance right up until he and his comrades went off the reservation, so to speak. And no, you goat-dancing imbeciles, I am not making that up. In point of fact, a friend of mine recently sent me a very rare historical recording, which I'm going to play for you now. This is Robert J. Matthews, the founder and martyred leader of the Order, addressing the annual Labor Day Leadership Conference of the National Alliance in Arlington, Virginia on September the 4th, 1983, approximately 3 weeks before the meeting at Matthews Farm in Medellin Falls, Washington, where he formed the Order.
Thank you, Mike. My brothers, my sisters, from the mist-shrouded forested valleys and mountains of the Pacific Northwest, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty as members of the vanguard of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. The signs of awakening are sprouting up across the Northwest, and no more so than amongst the two-fisted farmers and ranchers, a class of our people who have been hit especially hard by the filthy, lying Jews and their parasitical usury system. From the beginning of this nation to the present, the yeoman farmer has been a symbol of the Aryan work ethic, a living monument to masculinity. Whenever I think of the first American Revolution, I often remember that stirring poem about Concord and Lexington. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, here the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. Unfortunately, comrades, that poem glorifies a fratricidal conflict. How I dream of a new poem, a poem for today. Out of the valleys, out of the fields, pour the Aryan yeoman horde, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Thence the Aryan farmers came and removed the Jew forever, forever from this world. Let us not forget, however, that the Levantine vermin are well aware of the dangers that an aroused and angered yeomanry represent to them. The tillers of the soil have always been something of a mystery to the Jews. Cities corrupt, while the soil, the valley, the field, the farm, they revitalize and replenish a weakened and drained mind and body. How the weaselly little city-dwelling Jew fears and suspicions the Aryan farmer. What a contrast in mind and body between the two. I think that deep within the breast of our Aryan yeomanry lies a long dormant seed, the seed of a racial awakening, the seed of resurgence, the seed of anger, and the seed of the will to act. We must radicalize the American yeomanry. We must bring as many of them as possible into our vanguard for victory. The task is not going to be easy. TV satellite dishes are springing up like poisonous mushrooms across the domain of the tillers of the soil. The electronic Jew is slithering into the living rooms of even the most remote farms and ranches. The race-destroying DOMs are everywhere. Allied with the Jews in their attempt to neutralize the Aryan farmer is the ever-present local rural pastor or minister. My personal experience has shown that usually the only organized opposition we will encounter when organizing in a farming or ranching community is from some local pastor. However, the stranglehold that the churches have upon rural America is fast eroding. That stranglehold is fast eroding because the average American farmer and rancher is in extreme financial difficulty. When a man is on the verge of losing his second-generation farm, his livelihood, and in essence his whole life, due mostly to the Jew usury system, he finds little solace in theological baggage from the Levant. I'm particularly encouraged by the success that Texas Klan leader Louis Beam has had in organizing amongst the farmers and independent truckers. He's shown us the way, now we must do it for the Alliance. The potential is there. Working out of a base in northern Idaho, he created an organization called NOFIT, National Organization of Farmers and Independent Truckers. The slogan is, don't throw a fit, throw a bureaucrat. A Beam, working with actual farmers and truckers from the Northwest, has managed within a few months to reach out and radicalize thousands of these kinsmen. I was talking to a young lady recently who works as a waitress in a large truck stop at Rock Springs, Wyoming. Every time NOFIT puts out a new newsletter, they send her 500 copies. She said they are all gone within a few days, with many of the truckers either joining on the spot or subscribing to the newsletter. The regime in Washington, D.C. is extremely worried about the further radicalization of the American farmer. Fortunately, instead of implementing a program that will genuinely help the farmer, they're responding with massive shows of force and repression, so much the better. 60 miles south of Spokane, Washington, along the Idaho border, is a farming area we refer to as a Palouse. It's one of the richest farming areas in the world. In many places, the Palouse has topsoil that is an incredible 18 feet deep. Along with wonderful soil, the Palouse has a very favorable growing climate. Even so, comrades, many farms in the Palouse are being foreclosed upon. I have met and talked with one of these unfortunate farmers, a kinsman by the name of Ray Smith. Mr. Smith is a large-framed, ruddy-faced man who likes to refer to himself as, quote, a Snake River cowboy and damn proud of it. His father farmed the land he lives upon, and Mr. Smith was recently planning to retire and let his son take over the farm. Mr. Smith's dreams have been shattered, and he's on the verge of losing his 2,000-plus acres, his home, and his son's future livelihood. Mr. Smith, to his credit, took a long, good look at his problem and how he arrived at so starry a state. Now take heart, kinsman. What did Mr. Smith say when he came to the root cause of his problem? Mr. Smith said, Jew! 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 Not only did Mr. Smith say Jew, he yelled Jew. His neighbor started yelling Jew. And how did the system react? By sending a plane, a helicopter, a bulldozer, SWAT teams from all over the state of Washington, and 60 very heavily armed deputies to the foreclosure on Mr. Smith's farm. Needless to say, Mr. Smith is now a member of NOFIT, and so are his neighbors. Mr. Smith also travels all over the state of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, speaking out about the Jews and handing out copies of the Protocols of Zion. We need this man in the Alliance. Radicalization of the American farm movement is also taking place in the Dakotas and Colorado. Last week, I talked at length to a Colorado-based racialist activist who has extensive personal experience dealing with the Colorado farmers. Several years ago, this gentleman distributed huge amounts of WRAs and other literature to farmers and ranchers around Fort Collins, Colorado. His efforts bore fruit, but soon after his initial literature distribution, he witnessed the birth of the anti-Jewish, pro-white Farmers Liberation Army. The feds are extremely panicked about this outfit. The same gentleman also gave me copies of the Primrose and Cattleman's Gazette, published in Fort Lupton, Colorado. This is an excellent little rural newspaper with a considerable circulation, which is geared towards the needs and interests of the farmer and rancher. What's interesting about this newspaper, in this issue, is an excellent little article on the Protocols of Zion. This issue here is a full-page advertisement for a very anti-Jewish, pro-white racialist organization. The Jews are coming down hard in this brave little newspaper like chickens on a June bug. It appears that it might eventually fold up, but the seeds have been sown. So comrades, I have briefly informed you of the potential for our movement, which lies within the farming communities across this nation. We must, it is our duty to, take advantage of the ever-increasing radicalization of the American farmer. The fate of every last white man, woman, and child on this planet lies squarely on the shoulders of us here in this room today. Out of all the white racialist organizations in this nation, the Alliance, and only the Alliance, has the potential to bring us to victory. Through the Alliance lies a salvation for our entire race. We cannot fail. Therefore, let us not only preach, let us live racial economics. Meddling Falls, we are not only eating, breathing, and sleeping, we are growing together as one mind and one body. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. Meddling Falls, we know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours, our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance and the responsibilities thereof, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. In Meddling Falls, we have a saying, defeat never, victory forever.
I can well understand why William Pierce tried to bury this recording for many years because he was in the audience, and if the U.S. attorney'd had a mind to, it could have been used as evidence to try and implicate him in some kind of criminal conspiracy with Matthews, especially in view of that $300,000 that mysteriously fell out of the sky a year later, and which Pierce used to purchase the property in Hillsborough, West Virginia, but we won't get into that. Now, if and when an actual NVA ever appears in the Northwest, I can tell you that unless they start doing things like bombing kindergartens or other stuff which indicates clearly to me that these are actually federal agents pulling a black op, I will not react the way Pierce did as regards the order. Now, Pierce publicly did all he could to distance himself from Matthews and the order, including publicly denouncing them and disassociating himself from Matthews and then denying he'd ever met him, which is kind of ridiculous in view of the recording we've just heard. Even at the same time that Pierce was mysteriously acquiring $300,000 from wherever he got it. I'm using that terminology because I don't think Pierce ever openly discussed or admitted just where this mysterious windfall that enabled him to purchase the Hillsborough property and set up the first prefab buildings there actually came from, although everybody and his dog in the movement knows. But nonetheless, I'll take my cue from Pierce himself, respect his wishes, and say no more. Again, I won't make any moral judgments on that, but all I can say is that if that ever happens to me, I will not comport myself in the same manner, and we'll just let it go at that. As far as any so-called NVA goes, I will never denounce or renounce or distance myself from anyone with a white skin who is engaging in active resistance, no matter how wrong-headed I may consider them to be, unless I am convinced to a moral certainty that whatever and whoever it is a hoax and a black op or false flag operation. Unfortunately, given the nature of the people who rule us, that will always be a possibility. Now, beyond that, if I'm ever convinced that there is a genuine white racial struggle taking place using whatever means, I will give that struggle and the people involved in it every bit of unambiguous and full support I can in whatever way I can. But again, I'll tell you how to tell if any so-called NVA is real. It's real if they hit targets that actually cause loss and damage to the system. And if I get dragged away to some undisclosed location and disappear. When this system is seriously threatened, they will move fast and hard, and they will not give a damn for the Constitution or habeas corpus or anybody's rights but their own, any more than Abraham Lincoln did in 1861. Now, speaking of the Civil War, here's a combination Civil War and cowboy song, which I may or may not have played before. I found this in my archive of RFN played music, but I looked on my list and I can't find when I played it before. One way or the other, this mad cow disease is starting to creep up on me like Denny Crane. Anyway, this is Grandpa Jones.
Jesse James was a man who rambled through the land. He robbed many bank and train. He was leader of a band, a bold and wicked band. Many are the people that were slain. Oh, no more Jesse James, no more Jesse James, for they laid poor Jesse in his grave. As he went to turn his head, little Bobby shot him dead, and they laid poor Jesse in his grave. Jesse was an expert
Every week, I get dozens of emails from well-meaning people who send me news media stories off the internet. Just like in the old pre-internet days, I used to get huge envelopes full of newspaper clippings. Stories telling me things that I already know. Stories telling me how bad it all is. These people are saying to me, "Oh, Harold, look at what they're doing to us now. Isn't it all just so horrible, Harold?" Yes, it is horrible. It's unconscionable. It's unforgivable. So why don't we do something about it? We can do something about it, and all of you know what it is. God knows I've spent the last 10 years telling you what you can do about it all. We can create our own country. It has been done before, more than once. What the hell do you think our ancestors were doing when they got on those leaky wooden sailing ships from Europe? The Jews themselves have done it within living memory. We could do it exactly as the Jews did, beginning in 1898 when they laid out the protocols of the Elders of Zion in Basel, Switzerland at the First Zionist Congress. We can select a parcel of land. The Pacific Northwest would do nicely. And then we can all actually go there. Take it over by a lifetime of hard work and struggle using whatever means come to hand. And finally liberate it politically from the control of the United States and create our own sovereign white nation. A nation which may or may not someday become strong enough to kick down the door and take back all of North America. Although that's so far in the future, we don't need to worry about it now. For the next couple of generations, all the white man needs to worry about is survival. Can such a thing be done, assuming leadership, luck, courage, and perseverance? Absolutely. Will it be done? I keep asking you folks that every week. Maybe someday you'll give me an answer. I have stated before that within certain very narrow and limited parameters, certain historical parallels do in fact apply to our present situation, most notably the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 and the Irish War of Independence from 1916 to 1921. The Weimar Germany situation of the 1930s may also become relevant here in a way that it never has been before, now that a cataclysmic economic collapse is finally on the horizon for real. Now, there's another parallel, the formation of the State of Israel, as distasteful as we may find the people involved. There are parallels down to the past century in the form of African and Asian colonial wars. We tend to disregard these examples because of our own hatred for non-whites and our reluctance to admit that non-whites could quote-unquote beat white armies, and also because many of these situations are admittedly kind of ambiguous in other ways, politically and economically, but the fact remains that there are in fact some useful observations that we can make from the past. Now, the basic formula for winning successful colonial wars has been replicated many times. It is susceptible to intelligent analysis and reproduction, and we could very conceivably apply it to our own situation here in North America, were we ever able to find within ourselves the will to do so. Now let's review the revolutionary tripod. I've spoken of this before, the three indispensable components which must be present in any successful revolution. First, there must be a revolutionary movement. Disciplined and organized and motivated with a clear political plan and a strategy for implementing that plan. Secondly, there has to be withdrawal of consent to be governed on the part of the majority of the people of the territory under question. Now, this is achieved through a combination of economic and political circumstances affecting their daily lives to the point where they come to hate and fear the established authority, and also by propaganda on behalf of the revolution. You know, as far as them coming to hate and fear established authority, the people in the Northwest are already halfway there. Finally, the ruling power or authority must lose their credible monopoly of armed force, lose their ability to punish those who resist. In other words, revolutionaries must commit serious and sustained acts of resistance, get away with it, and be seen to get away with it. This eventually leads to the government overreacting and committing reprisal atrocities against the local population, and that in turn reinforces the other two legs of the tripod, so forth and so on. Always bear in mind one thing. Colonial wars are not won by the so-called freedom fighters, nor are they lost by the generals and the politicians of the occupying power. They are lost by the accountants. The strategic goal of the revolutionaries must be to make it so costly in manpower, money, and lost revenues for the occupiers to maintain their grip on the colony so as to make the occupying power so weary of the whole mess that they decide to cut their losses. Eventually, after many long years of increasingly pointless carnage and destruction, the accountants will go to the politicians in Washington, D.C. and show them the long columns of red ink which continued attempts to hold on to the Northwest are generating, and they're going to tell those congressmen and senators and bureaucrats, this has to end. We are being bankrupted by this situation. Find some way to get our asses out of there. Now, the object of the Northwest migration, from our point of view, will be eventually to create our own version of the tripod in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Western Montana, British Columbia, and possibly Alberta and Alaska and Northern California. We'll see how that plays out. This is a damned big territory, to be sure, but it's still smaller and more practical to work with than the entire continental United States. There are still more than enough racially aware whites in North America to carry out this plan if we ever decide we want to implement it. We will be assisted immensely by the fact that an organic or natural movement into the Northwest is already taking place by whites who are fleeing from diversity. Now, the first thing one notices in Seattle is that half the local inhabitants seem to be from somewhere else, mostly from Southern California. These organic migrants will, of course, cut off their own ghoulies rather than admit that they've fled from enforced association with third world mud. They use all the right code words like good schools and clean air and less congestion and so forth and so on. But eventually, many of these organic migrants will join forces with us, and our ranks will be swelled by people who, in the main, are comfortably off and who have talents and skills which are going to be of immense use in the building of a new state. Our state. Once the tripod is created, the federal government of the United States, which has always been substantially weaker, more incompetent, more stupid, and more demoralized than we've ever given it credit for being, will eventually be forced to cut its losses and agree to give us back at least a small portion of our country. Now, in view of the fact that it is simply no longer possible to take all of the United States back, this is the victory we must seek. I am not saying that this will be easy. It won't be. It will be an ordeal of soul-crushing difficulty, and it will take a whole generation at the very least. It will require an amount of blood, sweat, and tears greater than that put into almost anything else our people have ever done on this continent. Okay, I get it. Most of you regard the very idea that you would ever actually do any of this to be insane. But once again, I have to ask you, what do you think your life is going to be like even a few years from now? Do you understand that you are going to get old someday? That most likely you are going to end your days in a so-called state-run nursing home? A kind of filth-encrusted warehouse for old white people waiting to die? Probably going to end up waiting for Dr. Goldstein to come around and decide you're past your sell-by date and put you down with an injection. You do understand, don't you, that if nothing changes, your last years on this earth are going to be a kind of hell that we can't even really imagine now, as you are cared for by the Filipino and Nigerian and Somali immigrant staff in your little nursing home. Why in God's name would anyone not try to do something to prevent that from happening to them? I will never understand that. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom. Freedom.